Skyjacking to Cuba. Can this really happen in general aviation? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. By now, if you're a regular listener to our special feature on Monday, you know that this is the day we get together to talk about safety topics with Bob, sometimes in somewhat candid terms, and today we're going to make no exception. Bob, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
Well, Paul, as always, I enjoy being here with you.
Let's talk about something that was in the May edition of Over the Airwaves. You had an article headlined, "Does This Stuff Really Happen Anymore?" And it had to do with, I guess there's no other way to put it, an attempted terrorist takeover of, well, no, actually, this would be a hijacking. Someone who didn't want to die or use the plane as a bomb, but somebody who, harkened back to the 70s, wanted to fly to Cuba. Tell us about this. This was a GA aircraft.
Yeah, this was this one really caught my curiosity when I read about it. A story, you know, it looked like a typical, you know, kind of a discovery flight scenario where a pilot agrees to take another couple up for a ride, and they were in a Piper Cherokee 6. And at 5,500 feet along the route of flight, the passenger pulls out a small knife, reaches forward, turns off the radios, transponder, and then demands to be flown to Cuba, of all things. And unfortunately, the outcome was not good. The pilot, in an effort to disarm or, you know, deactivate, if you will, the hijacker, pushed the airplane over into a negative G pushover, causing the hijacker to get suspended on the cabin. And then eventually the airplane crashed in the ocean with fatalities. And I thought to myself, you know, does this stuff really happen anymore? And if so, what should we do as pilots to prepare ourselves for such an eventuality?
This is just kind of goofy all the way around.
It is goofy, and perhaps more so in this hypersensitive environment we have, where an individual who, you know, either wants to do himself in or, in fact, make headlines in the local newspaper. But I know over at our flight school, we do dozens of discovery flights every month with people virtually unknown to us. We don't pass them through any kind of a screening process. We don't, you know, search them or pat them down for weapons. And I'm thinking, you know, this is absurd. I've never even come remotely close to having a disruptive passenger on board any of the flights that I've taken. But like so many other things, you know, it's just that once in a lifetime event where you have to say to yourself, if it does happen, you know, how many of us really do take transponder code 7500 seriously? And if we do throw it in the transponder, what might we expect in terms of an ATC response? I can only imagine if I started squawking 7500 and then made a quick move to downtown Buffalo over the city, would that in fact cause some reactionary event to take place? You know, would they launch a helicopter to see what we were up to? I suspect they very well might.
You know, this raises a whole bunch of interesting issues, because obviously you're in a location where not too many crazed hijackers want to get to Fort Erie, Ontario. So you're not going to have the problem like they might in Key West, where this issue you cite happened. But I guess we need to think about what we might do or what measures we might take, because this, like it or not, this is a fear that's being promoted by a lot of people outside general aviation as a real threat to the security of the nation. And our friend who flew into the IRS building didn't really help things too much.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it does ask the question, what should we do? And I know myself, when I or anybody in our flight school takes somebody up on a discovery flight, I suppose we do look them over a little bit more closely and we talk to them. But none of us are trained to, you know, detect or discern who would have evil intent, number one. But that's always a good idea. Check out as best you can who you're taking up. Number two, you don't know what that hijacker code is, 7500, and don't be afraid to use it. And, you know, if things really begin to deteriorate, maybe it would be a good idea to point the airplane to some other location than a highly urbanized area. And then number four, I've oftentimes joked with students that I know very well saying that, you know, I have a flashlight behind my seat that I can grab, you know, one of these 6D cell flashlights that's heavy enough to, you know, knock the person, you know, unconscious, you know, if need be. But I've also been asked, you know, is there anything that they can do that I as a flight instructor cannot undo? You know, if they get the airplane into an unusual attitude, can I undo it? And I always explain that, you know, I have a complete set of dual controls, and unless they are truly intent on doing us in, yes, I can more or less undo anything they do. But if they're intent on, you know, committing suicide by airplane, it's very unlikely that I would be able to correct the situation short of disabling them completely. You know, does this mean we should carry a stun gun on board the airplane? Does this mean that I should use my left elbow to literally knock them unconscious? Hey, when you debate that subject and you come to the conclusion that this individual is really out to harm you, or, you know, put the airplane at risk, or worse, take out some people on the ground, I suppose any and all means would be justified, including pulling a .38 caliber pistol out of the glove compartment if you could get to it, and shooting him between the ears. I mean, this is pretty gruesome stuff to be talking about, and I'm really, like I said at the onset of our discussion, this is so extremely rare as to does it rise high enough on our radar screen of safety concerns or risk management, risk assessment issues to even be concerned about. But I think anything is fair game today. We have to be prepared for any potential eventuality up there as best we can and to deal with it.
Well, Bob, all I can say is if you have a 6D cell flashlight, you must have at one point been a chaperone.
Yeah, right. Or I haven't come up with the newer technology of LED lights, you know, that we can fit in, you know, at the end of our fingertip.
When we come back from the break, Bob, let's talk about an article you had in the May edition called Dreams Fulfilled, and you made an analogy to a playpen I want to talk about. Bob Miller is my guest. Back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, talking about how learning to fly is like life itself. Bob, you made this analogy in the May edition of the newsletter and started it out with a quote from Judy Garland that says, "We cast away priceless time and dreams, born of imagination, fed upon illusion, and put to death by reality," unquote. Tell us how this quote inspired you to write what you wrote and how you relate these two things together.
You know, one of the reasons that that I enjoy flight instruction particularly is the witnessing firsthand of the excitement on an individual's face as they accomplish something in the process of learning how to fly, whether it's the solo or the first unassisted landing or obtaining their pilot certificate. That's a tremendous sense of satisfaction that any of us who sit in the right seat and provide that instruction feel. But on the other hand, and perhaps more so and far more than we like, I have seen individuals give it up. They get to a point in their flight training where forces of reality, either the job or they ran out of money or pressures at home or illness or some factor interceded and interrupted their flight training. And it's at that moment we witness the loss of a dream. And, you know, we receive all kinds of explanations and excuses, if you will, as to why they had to stop. But nonetheless, it is a failure to attain a dream, that lost dream. It's such a sad thing. And Judy Garland, who, you know, suffered her own evils and devils in her life, made this point, too, that the reality of life is such that it can get in the way of accomplishing what it is that we want to achieve. And that's what prompted me to write the article. I think there are things that we allow to get in the way that if we truly, truly set our heart on something and set in place the events that we need to do to accomplish it, we can be successful.
Well, but there is a line we have to walk, Bob, too. You mentioned that there are folks who have a dream and refuse to call it quits. These brave individuals muster forth in an unyielding pursuit of their goal. Obviously, we have to set up our lives, you know, to be structured in such a way that we are surrounded by people who either share that dream or are willing to acknowledge that it's important to us and pursue it.
Sure. I mean, one sets their own priorities. And flying, you know, for most of us, for many of us, is purely a recreational endeavor. I understand that. And sure, given the choice between flying lessons and paying for our children's college education, yes, I mean, there are priorities that need to be set. But, you know, children don't spend their lives in college. You know, once the child is out of college and off on their own, you know, that's when we see the 50, 60-year-old individuals coming out to the airport saying, now is the time I want to learn how to fly. You know, and they put it off for all of this time, and now they're going to make it happen. But then they see other things. I've seen individuals, older folks in particular, come out and say, well, you know, I don't think I can pass my medical. Well, we have a light sport program that you very well may qualify for, really, you know, and we go down that way. So there's usually ways around or through. I discovered this even with our 141 application to become an FAA-approved flight school. You know, you have to go through the hoops sometimes. Sometimes you have to go through endless inspections, endless paperwork. But if you want it bad enough, those of us who persevere, you know, eventually we'll make it. It just may take us, each of us, a little bit longer than others. But either way, if that's what we want to do, then let's do it. And I tried to make the point in the article, as all of our listeners know, you know, flying is one of the greatest privileges and thrills there are for individuals to attain. I mean, there's nothing like it. And to lose sight of that thrill and give up through, you know, for seemingly insignificant reasons, that to me is such a heartache to see that. Maybe part of the problem is that we as flight instructors do not continue to reinforce that joy of flying, telling them what it's like at the other end of the pond, you know, when you get there and when you have your certificate and the privileges that you have to enjoy. This is something that I think many of us flight instructors have to work very hard to keep that dream alive and give them the incentive and the motivation to persist to see this thing through.
Well, thanks, Coach. I feel much better. Bob, I think with that, we'll let folks read the article. And thank you much. We'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
Bob Miller's newsletter can be found on the web at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.